Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Before we get to our Rethink the Week panel, I want to remind everyone that we begin with the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. Perhaps more than ever now, we need to know what a patriot means. We need to know what they sound like. We have to understand what sacrifice means. Maybe the GOP needs to listen to Colonel Vindman on a regular basis, not my radio audience, but you get the benefit of his powerful testimony. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Well, it's Rethink the Week, which keeps feeling more and more like Rethink the Year, but they pack so much into 7 days. And of course, we're actually Zooming this show on Monday morning. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to tell you what happens at the convention, which is going to be all online. And we're all going to be sort of watching in our TV sets, but it begins tonight. So the Democrats put forth their best image, their best talkers, and explain to the American people why they are the answer in November of 2020. Joining us for our Rethink the Week is our great panel. Robert Hennelly is at Stuck Nation. He writes for Insider NJ, or is it NJ Insider?
Insider NJ.com,
The Chief Leader, Salon.com. He is prolific. You hear him on public radio in New York as well. So let me welcome back to the program, Robert Hennelly. How are you, Bob?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Dean Spiliotis, you hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
And Stephen Pimper, he is a senior fellow at the Carsey Institute. He teaches at UNH Manchester as well. He is a writer, an author, and again has been heard on many sort of national shows. But his area of expertise really, I think, is poverty and homelessness and sort of all the challenges that I think to a large extent, Stephen, more and more people are facing, and people who never expected to be on a food line. People who never expected to be at a food bank. That to me is the most interesting story, is to watch the cars, Stephen, line up in Texas, watch the cars line up in Louisiana, and people in the cars going, I've never had to do this before. I've never had to do this before. And the sense of vulnerability is overwhelming. But of course, that's something you've been studying for a long time. So welcome to the program, Stephen.
To be here, Arnie. And just as a footnote, that's not unusual. I started working in soup kitchens and food pantries in New York in the late 80s, early 90s. And it is a regular occurrence to have families show up and say, I've never done this before, and sort of processing their feelings of fear and shame simultaneously. What we're seeing now, the scale of it is different, but that experience is not.
Right. And look, I've lost my job many times. I've had to go on Cobra many times. I've had to go bareback without Cobra because I couldn't afford Cobra many times. I've actually lived in an apartment where we would compare the size of our cockroaches. Okay. I now live in a freaking mansion. So I look at where I live today, and having lived with the cockroaches, I am so aware of that sort of sense of vulnerability. It's unbelievable. But I want to talk a little bit about what's going to be happening tonight. Tonight's the beginning of the Democratic Convention, and we saw a significant level of enthusiasm. We knew that Kamala Harris was a very predictable candidate. We knew she was probably going to be the one. The Democratic Party for a long time actually signaled that they really kind of wanted Kamala. But Bob, I'm going to start with you, in part maybe because you're hanging out in New Jersey. And that is that I read the article at Slate.com about her immigrant story. And what is really remarkable is that it really is, all of us for the most part, except for Native Americans, have an immigrant story. But her immigrant story is so immediate because of her father from Jamaica, because of her mother from India, because they came over as adults. So she got to sort of see their lives, see the challenges, see the discrimination as she grew up, even trying to figure out who she was because she was half Black and half Indian. So in a lot of ways, she had a frontline position to sort of understand and see things in real time that many people may have heard from their grandparents, or they may sort of read stories about, but she lived it, Bob.
Yeah, I think that this is, many of these trends for social uplifting take generations. But then there is a point where enough change is accumulated that there is a turning point, a particular moment in time, and that's the period that she came of age in. One of the things that I'm keeping an eye on here is that I think we have to remember that Donald Trump was elected and got through this process because he was successful in turning roughly 200 counties or 20 congressional districts that had voted for President Obama twice, 2008 and 2012. And then what really happened was not so much the activation of the white male, white supremacist grievance vote, but the demobilization of 700,000 to a million African-American voters who did not turn out, right, who had turned out in 2008 and 2012, for whom there had been no recovery in places like Cleveland, where their homes were in foreclosure and where the Obama administration's approach to the recovery saved Wall Street at the price of MLK Boulevard and Main Street.
Thank you. And I've been grieving that story over and over and over again, and people don't get it. I look at Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton created this sort of rise of Wall Street and this extreme gap between rich and poor with the deregulation of derivatives and with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, and to a large extent what you saw happen to the vulnerable Black community with what welfare reform and then the crime bill. And then I see Barack Obama after the next sort of this huge crash, you know, ultimately coming back and helping Wall Street recover and Main Street still struggling. And I think that's the part that people don't understand. We were building on failure instead of addressing what was the underwriting sort of problem there. And I think that does give you rise to Donald Trump.
I just wanted to say one thing that we see an echo and reprise of that in Trump's response to the COVID pandemic. And now I'll be quiet.
No. But what I love what Bob said, Dean Spiliotis, because it is true. It usually takes generations. It's not that you didn't come from a family of immigrants, but it was your grandparents or your great grandparents. And by the time you ran, you may still have had those stories. I mean, Michael Dukakis, I think, was the only other person, you know, whose parents were from Greece. But for the most part, it's a very interesting story. I remember Dean running for governor and someone telling me that I wasn't from New Hampshire, that I was a New Yorker, and therefore I had New York values and I could not be the governor of New Hampshire. So it wasn't even that I was from another country. I was from another state, Dean Spiliotis. And Dean, I remember them saying that I couldn't become the governor. And I said, you know, I remember my Norwegian grandmother, because she was an immigrant from Norway. I can remember my Norwegian grandmother in her Norwegian accent saying, "Yeah, it's good in America." And I remember saying on that radio show, imagine how proud my Norwegian grandmother would be to see her granddaughter running for governor in New Hampshire. It's called the American dream. But I pointed back to my grandmother. What you see with Kamala is that she lived it because her parents came when they were adults. And so again, it's a very rich and real experience, I think, Dean Spiliotis.
Absolutely. I mean, we all have our, as you said, we all have our immigrant stories. My grandparents all came over from Greece, all four of them, to work. And you look just two generations later, all of my siblings and cousins have advanced degrees and flourishing careers. And I think it would be remarkable for my grandparents to see where their descendants are now. And it just happens in a matter of one or two generations, typically. And that's in many respects the American story, and it's a very powerful story, and I think she has an opportunity to make that fresh for people.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, the earlier point about about demobilization of African-American voters. When you look at the data and you look at the rate, I've recently saw some national data on turnout of African-American voters over the last three or four presidential elections. And you look at the drop in African-American vote for Hillary Clinton from Barack Obama in 2012 to 2016, it's remarkable, 6, 7, 8 points down in some areas. And that really made the difference.
Well, and Stephen, I want you to weigh in here, but I think about two things. Remember that when Bill and Hill ran for president in 1992, at some point they jokingly said that Bill Clinton was the first African-American president. Of course, he was not. And then you fast forward, you have Barack Obama who does run. But then what Barack Obama does is he bails out Wall Street and doesn't bail out Main Street. And to some extent, I think even the African-American community who was so excited about him being president, we're kind of wondering, what about us? What about us? We know Jamie Dimon's happy, you know, but Jimmy down the street ain't so happy. And I think so. And then you've got, you know, Hillary, who made certain assumptions that, you know, she was owed this. She didn't show up in certain states. She didn't, you know, she may have had a lot of policies, but she actually never really talked about those policies. So I think what you saw with the African-American community is not surprising when you see that drop off. And when you see her losing in states that historically Democrats never lost in, it's because they were beginning to say, we elected Democrats, what did it get us? And I think that's the tragedy of this story, Stephen.
I mean, I think that's all right. And I align myself with everything that Dean and Bob said about demobilization. However, I think it's also important that we pay attention to another aspect of the demobilization, which is the systematic, consistent efforts of Republicans at all levels of government to do what is within their power to dissuade likely Democratic voters from being able to vote. And I think that is something that we don't have good analytic tools to tease out, right? We sort of don't do a great job at figuring out with great sophistication who is not showing up and why they are not showing up, how much of this is removing voting machines from low-income communities and tripling the length of time it takes for someone there to vote so that they're more likely to walk away, yada, yada, right? All of that sort of stuff that has been going on for what, more than a decade now across the United States. I think we need to factor that in too. And obviously that becomes a piece of the puzzle as we start to think about Trump's efforts to disrupt the election in November.
Boy, it sounds like a toxic cocktail as I'm listening to you. And that's the problem, Bob. We all want a simple answer. We all want to point, change this and it will work. Change that and it will work. But what you're hearing from the three of you is that look at all these different pieces that you sort of add together, and what you get is a synergistic effect, and ultimately it creates a Trump. It really does. And yet what we're seeing now, and I want to go back, exactly, you were a perfect bridge to this topic. What's happening with the Postal Service is interesting. What's happening with ballots is interesting. In our little state of New Hampshire, we had the Republican Party send out what appeared to be a request for an absentee ballot. They claim they sent it to only Republicans, but we know a lot of Democrats and independents that got it. And the return address for this information went to Durham, New Hampshire, Durham spelt Wong, at a P.O. box. If you're getting an absentee ballot, it has to go to your city or town clerk. It doesn't go to one address. So not only was it inaccurate, it went to an inaccurate location. And they claim it was a mistake. The timing of their mistake, the point of the mistake, when you had the attorney general who's a Republican and he was asked to investigate, he said, oh, there's nothing to see. It was a typo. And I'm thinking, a typo at this point in time ain't a typo, Bob Hennelly.
Well, I think that when the Republicans in the Senate were unable to muster the political courage to turn out Donald Trump, they set themselves in for what is really something that is going to haunt them historically. And now what we're seeing is, I just got a communication this morning from the president of the Post Office Uniform Police Officers Union, several hundred, mostly officers of color that protect the physical plant of the U.S. Post Office, and they're in uniform. And they're being told to stand down from their statutory and traditional obligation of protecting the physical movement of the mail. we're now really past something into a new phase of a dictatorial takeover. And the problem is our convention for discussing it carries with it that kind of same old and lacks the kind of urgency, because in commercial broadcasting, it's brought with ads from Mercedes-Benz and Viking cruises. But we're into something very different now. I'm heartened to see the speaker is bringing the House back. But my concern is that if the House is as ineffective in terms of dealing with things like, remember old hits from the spring, like hazard pay for essential workers, my concern is it could be too little too late.
Wow.
Could I just follow up, Bob? Where are the prosecutors? Where are the police? I mean, this is a felony, what they're doing, telling the Postal Service protection officers to stand down when crimes are being committed, when the Republicans are carting sorting machines out of the Postal Service. They started to remove mailboxes from where people were used to dropping things off. Why doesn't somebody like an AG who is aggressive go after these guys and put a stop to it? The court and have a judge look at it.
What's apocryphal here is to look what happened with the meat processing plants. When Trump overrode local public health concerns, Rachel Maddow did a great job reporting this, picking up on local newspapers. Back when Trump used the War Powers Act to override the union's local concerns about the spread of COVID, what did Mr. Trump could do? He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. Ooh, I'm so scared. He's going to write an op-ed in the New York Times. Like in another world, supposing that none of that product got to market, supposing if no retail workers put any of it out, but that didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
Back when he wrote the op-ed, there were how many dead union meatpacking workers? 20. It is now close to 200. Of course, the infection rate was, I think, we were around 70,000 people had died in the U.S. Now we're closing in on 200,000.
That's why I mentioned an ongoing criminal operation and an AG and getting to court, because at least you can go to court more quickly. To wait for Congress to enact something, that's never going to happen.
So, Dean, the one thing I think that's interesting, and again, what Bob just told me is just beyond sobering. I think we're all sitting here just shaking our heads going, oh my God, that too. I mean, I feel like every time there's another stone drops and you're shocked because you didn't even know the post office had these things. And now you know they don't have these things. I mean, I'm learning more about sorting machines. I'm learning about what they do. I'm learning about all these delays. So one of the things I think, has he attacked the wrong thing? And that it is probably the most beloved institution in the United States, 91% approval. It was founded before the United States of America was founded. The first one was, I guess, in Pennsylvania, and it was Ben Franklin who was the first Postmaster General, and it was before 1776. In addition to which, rural America is so important to Donald Trump. It truly, truly is. And who will be the most sacrificed? Because even if you hear about, oh, they're taking away a sorting machine in Cleveland, or they're taking away a sorting machine in Chicago, they don't just serve Chicago. They serve all the satellite areas that go everywhere. And, you know, where you might get your drugs through Bezos, you might get them through Amazon or whatever, because they've taken over everything, you know, your pill box. You know that in rural America, you don't get an Amazon delivery truck, you get the USPS. So now you've got this conflation of, in Donald Trump's head, the only people that use the mail are people who are going to be voting. Like, that's the only reason why people use the mail. And I think that it's becoming a little more sobering that it is used for so many different reasons. Despite social media and email, there still is a concrete essential reason for it. And it's even more essential in places that have historically supported Donald Trump.
Yeah. And I think, you know, two things. The first thing is, you know, Donald Trump is not known for thinking through the long-term ramifications of whatever visceral reaction he has at the moment. And for him, this idea of mail-in ballots and the threat of losing because more Democrats will vote using an absentee or mail-in, he reacted to that. And he reacted in this particular way. And now we're starting to really see, when you think about it, the far-reaching impact this has. It also shows a little bit kind of how out of touch he is with how average Americans typically function in their daily lives. And particularly during the pandemic, mail has become essential. I mean, you know, we went through a period in recent years where people started to say, well, you know, everything is online now, and And, you know, you only use the mail for, you know, restaurant menus and free advertisements for whatever local businesses want to advertise. But the reality I think we're seeing is something different. And the difference here, and, you know, in addition to Trump not having long range thinking on this, is Republican members of Congress in areas that are traditionally Trump country or Republican country, they're hearing about it too. So this is not just a problem for Democrats in urban areas. It's a problem for all Americans. And I think as, you know, Trump often will backtrack once he sees where things are headed. You know, we'll see what happens.
Has the damage been done? But has the damage been done?
Exactly. After at least some damage has been done, yeah.
So I have to ask one maybe naive question. If you don't want people to vote by mail, and you know that historically you've encouraged, especially places like Florida, that this is really has been the skill set of Republicans, not Democrats. Democrats have now acquired this skill set because they're so worried about COVID-19, and it fits into their public health strategy, frankly, Stephen Pimper, because it's the Democrats who want you to mask. It's the Democrats who want you to social distance. It's the Democrats that want you to maybe stay home more than go out because they're concerned about the bars and the restaurants and the shopping and the whatever. And therefore, the vote by mail sort of fits into that whole milieu. Right, but it's historically been a Republican milieu, the idea of voting by mail. How do the senators think they're going to win if people can't vote by mail? How do you trust the integrity of the governors that win or lose, the senators that win or lose, the House members that win or lose? I mean, what Donald Trump doesn't understand is he's the only person they're voting for on the ballot. Does he realize how many other people are on the ballot? And what does that do to sort of that kind of chaos that is being created? And don't they want to win their judgeships or their Senate seats?
Well, I think we've got enough experience with Donald Trump to be able to say that it is unlikely that he is thinking about anyone other than himself, right? We've got pretty good evidence on the table for that. But, you know, also as we sort of think through what's going on with the post office and the has the damage already been done question is, you know, at some level, again, we're sort of going back to something Bob said, we're sort of stuck in an old way of thinking, right? It's like, well, he's trying to steal the election in order to ensure that he gets more votes than the other guy, right? Well, maybe that's not it, right? Maybe the determination is, regardless of what happens between now and whenever, he will declare himself the victor, and that the ultimate goal is to create enough utter and complete chaos that he opens up space to contest the election no matter what happens and no matter what happens with that vote, right? Right. The chaos itself, it seems to me, is possible that is the goal rather than a particular outcome in terms of votes.
So, Bob, given the fact that we have this economic downturn, we don't have the added benefits for unemployment, we see people losing their health care, we've got this chaos. I mean, how do you fight this, Bob? No. I mean, this is like there are so many chaotic things happening, and then you have the chaos enhancer in the name of Donald Trump. I am just trying to figure out, like, how do you even begin to approach a strategy? And I want to think outside the box, Bob, but I don't even know how far outside the box I have to go because it feels pretty effective.
Yeah, I think that the response is to stay in touch with and nurture your very local granular connections to your essential community so that you then become a like committee of correspondence, to borrow a page from the Revolutionary War. And by that, I mean, like, I'm getting over the weekend, even as the media was patting itself on the back for a victory, you may have heard the dust up over the postal Mr. DeJoy actually removing mailboxes from around the country. And then MSNBC did a victory lap that in Montana they were promised to restore them. But meanwhile, in Morristown, New Jersey, the county seat for Morris County, they were picking them up around the green. So this situational awareness has to be developed, and then we have to have authentic communication channels to counter the narrative, which try to uphold our local public officials, health officials. There's been some great reporting about particularly how female public health officials at the county and municipal level have been targeted because they lack support and been fired and terminated because they refuse to compromise public health standards. So I would say that it requires really committing ourselves to local action that is going to inform and drive the radical national change that's required.
So I was listening to you, and we have only have a few minutes, and then we'll go to the next half of the show. But as I'm listening to you, you were talking about the number of post boxes that were being taken out of Morristown. So I think you said being granular and being local. So if you see that you had a post box and it no longer exists, then you have to now go to that place and put something there and says, this post box was taken, return it. Imagine if that happened all over the country, because I don't know where your post box was. I don't live in your state. I don't live in your town, but you do. You see it, Dean Spiliotis. You know there was a post box there last week and there ain't one there this week. And people can start literally standing in that place going, bring back my post box. Can you imagine if that happens all over the country, Dean? Then when they're saying they're returning it, and they're going, I want mine now. And therefore you actually have people being able to sort of support the idea that this is where it's happening. What you're hearing, like MSNBC doing their victory lap in Montana. Well, there ain't a victory lap in Kansas. There ain't a victory lap in New Jersey. There ain't a, because we know it, because we now have the physical proof of it, Dean. And that also gives people a sense of ownership of what they see is being taken from them, Dean.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the fragmentation of community, I think, makes it a little bit difficult to get a sense of the scope of the problem. But, and, you know, social media is something where that can actually be very helpful in making these kinds of connections and getting that information out so that people understand, you know, the extent of this happening. And yeah, you do see these stories, but it's very hard to get an overall sense of scale for what is being done. You know, I keep seeing stories about it's happening here, and then the next day I hear a story and it's happening over there, but it's very hard to get a grip on exactly the extent of the damage that's being done.
You know what these are? These are like little mini protests. There's little mini protests. And what's great about them is like whack-a-mole, because they're showing up everywhere. And then all of a sudden you can connect them. All right, we need to go to a break. So I just need, and then I want to go back to an immigration story to start the second half of the show. That's all I'm going to tell you. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week with Dean Spiliotis, Robert Hennelly, and Stephen Pimpere. We'll be right back.
I went down to St. James and finally saw my baby lying there. She was stretched out on a long white table, so cold, so sweet, so fast. Let her go, God bless her. Wherever she may be, she can look this wide world over, but she'll never find a 77-year-old like me. 17 guards went to the cemetery. 17 guards sang a mournful song. 17 guards went to the cemetery. But only 16 of those guards came back home.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is our Rethink the Week. We return with our panel. We have Robert Hennelly, who writes for Salon.com. He's at Stuck Nation. He writes for The Chief Leader, and he writes for InsiderNJ.com. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks, Rob.
Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University, and he also has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Welcome back, Dean Spiliotis.
Hi, Arnie.
And Stephen Pimpere, professor at UNH Manchester, senior fellow at the Carsey Institute, and expert on areas of poverty and homelessness and everything that, unfortunately, now we're going to need his level of expertise more and more with each passing hour. Thank you, Stephen Pimpere, for joining us. So I saw a piece just before I came on the air, and I actually posted it as an aside, but because we began with Kamala and the whole immigration story, I wanted to start the second half with another immigration story. And this is a story that has businesses and the economy probably pretty frightened. Shocking. No one, not enough foreigners applied for H-1B visas this year. So the US government ran a second lottery. So surprising, what with the pandemic and Uncle Sam being so unwelcome for immigrants now, H-1B hopefuls have decided not to seek employment visas. Stephen Pimpere, this is usually they disappear within an hour. Okay. People need to understand how, you know, for the most part, H-1B visas are people with a significant level of expertise that are demanded by companies that say there isn't someone within the community that has this level. They literally like evaporate, and everyone always wants more and more H-1B visas. The fact that they actually had to run a second lottery speaks to the toxicity of Donald Trump when it comes to immigration policy, speaks to the fact that we're the worst practically compared to almost any other industrialized country in the world when it comes to how we're treating the pandemic. I mean, we're not allowed to go to Canada. We're not allowed to go to EU because nobody wants us there. I'm hearing stories of students who had to go to McGill, right? They were accepted at McGill University. So here's what happened. They get to the border, but they can't come across because they're Americans. But they have all this paperwork and documentation. So they allow their parents 6 hours to drive to Montreal, drop them off at a hotel or an Airbnb so they can be isolated for 2 weeks before they can actually begin to go to school at McGill. And they're not even sure, it depends on the day, whether they're actually going to be allowed to go across the border. That's just one of the stories about who we are. But that H-1B visa is, that, I think that's the first ever, Stephen.
There's also a story in the past week coming out of the administration of them contemplating stopping Americans returning to the United States coming across the southern border.
Yes.
And, you know, to me, I think all of this is in some ways of a piece, right? This is sort of Stephen Miller all over it, right? That it is prioritizing their notion of what it means to be an American and sort of taking that racism and xenophobia and prioritizing it as public policy and using the institutions of the state to create this white supremacist regime, right? I mean, I think it's useful that we really start. I mean, I've spent 3 years trying to not sound like an hysteric when talking about the actions of the Trump administration, right? Because it's hard to be taken seriously when you talk about rising fascism in the United States. We are seeing rising fascism in the United States. And as Bob said earlier, we don't have the language to talk about this, right? We don't have the experience to talk about this. We don't have the ways to think about the ways, how easy it turns out to be to turn the institutions of the state to aggressively repressive policies that are not in our interest, right? It's not as if closing off our borders is going to make us economically more viable, right? There is no upside to this unless you are a neo-Nazi.
Bob, do you want to comment on this story? Or do you want?
I mean, I think that what's also happening is in the area of healthcare, we are seeing a real crisis in a place that's already been devastated, which is in the congregate living facilities, nursing home facilities for the permanently disabled and for the elderly. This workforce has been essential, and it is a critical part of it is either undocumented or recently arrived and credentialed immigrants. And This ongoing war, which included the attempt by the Bush administration, by Trump, to go after public benefit, for instance, the idea that if you were living in a household where someone who is undocumented used any kind of public benefit, like say, and this happened a
food
lot,
stamps,
particularly in New York, if you were an undocumented adult and your children who are actual citizens avail themselves of any of the myriad of subsidized public health programs in New Jersey, New York, or any other state, you then are at risk of not being able to get permanent status. So this has been something that has actually been accelerating the inability of the state to fight the coronavirus too. So at the same time as it acts to do things like reduce the census count, scare people into the shadows, it's actually going after the workforce that's the front line, the so-called essential workers that we need to be able to contain and suppress the virus.
Oh God, Bob, I wish you were speaking at the Democratic convention. No, I forgot public benefit. I forgot that. I mean, there are so many things that he has done that are so traumatizing. There are so many things that he has done on top of the pandemic. There are so many, and that hurt our safety, that hurt our elderly. I mean, everyone thinks it's just them. Well, it's just the immigrant that's going to be impacted. It's just the poor people. I mean, they don't even understand the ripple effect throughout the entire economy, that this is brutalizing all of us, and we need to see those connections. And what you just did in 5 minutes will not be heard once during the New York Credit Convention, but yet needs to be heard over and over again, because it really threads us together and makes us realize what he is doing is so harsh and so unbelievable. It is just shocking. But you brought us into the healthcare piece, whether you liked it or not. So I'm now going to turn to you, Dean, because it's a great segue. And there was a physician, doctor, PhD from the Chen School. What's the school at Harvard? The public health school at Harvard?
Chan School of Public Health.
Yep. And it's a great piece, because what he said is, until we get a vaccine, and frankly, we know that at least maybe a third of the Americans won't even take the vaccine. And we know Russia is undermining our reliance on a vaccine by putting out their vaccine too soon without any kind of rigorous testing. He suggested that what we need to do is have these fast, immediate testing that would take place every single day, that would cost less than a buck, that you could take, it's just a little piece of paper, you either put your saliva on it, I don't know what you do with it, but and its level of accuracy is, yeah, maybe it's not 90%, but it's significant. And then if you were able to do it every single day.
Closer to 50% though is the problem.
He challenges that, because they're already coming through with some. But if you could do it every single day, especially when your virus is increasing, you're actually more capable of sharing it, you could immediately take action. And he said that would work, and it would be cost effective. It would open the economy. It would return us back to schools. Everyone could take a test every single day before they walked out of the house and have some knowledge of it. And I keep thinking that in a lot of ways, this is remarkable. You know what the problem is? Is that the pharmaceutical companies won't make money on it. Because if you look at what they're talking about for treatment and cost, if you're looking about what they're talking about the cost of a vaccine and cost, if you were able to do something that was an alternative to some of these things that were able to address it, not only would you be able to, from a public health perspective, be able to sort of re-engage the economy and schools again, but you would do it in an incredibly cost-effective way. And too many people, Dean Spiliotis, are seeing the pandemic as a huge profit opportunity.
Yeah, I think certainly for some portion of humanity, that's human nature. I think what you're talking about with these rapid, I think it's a rapid saliva test.
Yes.
You know, a couple things. I think the goal there obviously would be to slow the spread by catching people who are either asymptomatic or people who are pre-symptomatic. That is, people who are going to eventually go on and develop a full-blown illness. And then that cuts down the need for contact tracing and other, you basically nip it in the bud before somebody goes out into a large event or out into the world. I think, you know, that's certainly one possibility. Part of the problem, I think we're getting people to actually do that. I think, you know, some people will do it gladly, other people probably not so much. The whole world of pharmaceuticals and profits and all of that is very complex. It's often problematic. Certainly the speed at which vaccines are being developed is remarkable. As you suggested, let's only hope that whatever it is we end up with is safe and has gone through the proper protocols. It sort of sounds like Russia is doing phase 3 trials by actually just dosing people exactly. Broadly, and they're just going to kind of see what happens, I guess. I don't have an answer for this, but it's certainly more affordable testing. Obviously, pharmaceuticals are going to try to figure out how to make a profit. Whether that's more in vaccines versus testing, I don't know. I think just compliance, getting people to do a daily test, I think, you know, I think a lot of people would, but probably some people wouldn't.
Well, and the professor at the Chan School said he estimated that the nation's current testing strategy, Stephen, probably catches less than 3% of cases early enough to affect whether a person transmit the virus. 3%. But as long as those testing positives stay home, a cheap at-home regimen has the potential to provide a kind of artificial herd immunity, interrupting enough transmission nationwide to cause the pandemic to stall. And I think that there might this might actually be a Velcro piece. This is something where you're not asking people to mask up. You're not asking people to put something up their nose. That eventually you'll figure out who's not testing. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's almost like, so I don't know if you can get everyone to do anything 100%, but I think that this has got the potential to do this. And I'm wondering, why aren't we embracing things that we know are easier to sell to a nation that is so divided? We're divided about mask wearing. There was a story that came out that you didn't see this kind of division in 1918, but we're seeing this huge division now in 2020. And you would think that we were more sophisticated, but in some ways we are less, because we're willing to sort of follow Donald Trump down his, you know, whatever the strategy du jour is. I just thought this was just an interesting way of doing something as we await a vaccine. And I think you need to give people a sense that there is something they can do to control their lives.
And, you know, the what I had in mind earlier, some of the reading that I've done on the quick test suggests that they may have throw off 50%, give or take, false negative or false positives. But if it's easily accessible and it's cheap, if you've got people testing every couple of days, right, then that's okay, right? You can have a very high failure rate, false positive or false negative rate, but you're still going to wind up eventually catching people, radically reduce the number of people who are walking around in the world infected and shedding virus without knowing that they're doing that. That would be great, right? We're back to the same problem though, right? Is that there are all sorts of things that we could have been collectively doing over the course of the last 3, 4, 5 months, but most of them require coordination and funding at the national level for them to be fully effective. And it seems to me that there is no earthly reason to expect that until, in the best case scenario, the end of January 2021.
Okay, let's get back into politics. So, Bob,
I wanted to say, yes, something before you left, if I may. The thing is also, while we're talking about the need for a national focus on this, I have noticed a lack of coordination and engagement of the essential workforce in tracking this, even when you do get to a point where you have good reconnaissance. And I'll give you an example. In New York City now, we are getting to a place where we have enough testing. It's different than the rest of the country.
Yes.
Where you can develop some reconnaissance about where hotspots are. So we, for the last few weeks, we've been seeing, I guess, tests come in terms of positive in the aggregate below 1%, which is good news. But now they're able to identify hotspots where they found out, for instance, in Sunset Park, a community in Brooklyn, they had 6.7% people test positive. And so there's another place, Tremont in the Bronx and Rockaway in Queens. Do you know that until I called the detectives union and the EMT union, the city was not making the essential workers who have to go into the homes where people have died from COVID know about the latest information that they had in their possession about elevated hotspots? So while it's true that we lack a national focus, that means we have to really be smart in rethinking and engaging locally with the information we have.
Well, and you're, again, connecting the dots. So what's the point of knowing this information if you don't tell the people that are going to have to go into their homes when they get the 911 call? You're not telling the cops. I mean, it's just, again, you can't imagine that people aren't doing tabletop exercises all the time. Who do we have to tell? Now that we have this information, who needs to get it? This is just normal strategy for almost anything. And more than anything else, everybody should become a master of tabletop exercises so they can make sure that the people that need to know this information get the information immediately, as timely as possible, because that helps control the spread and it also controls their vulnerability, which we keep talking about. We so love them. We want to protect them. We put flags out in our windows and we thank them and clap. Well, I don't want someone to clap for me. I want someone to tell me, which is what is so shocking.
Yeah, Ken? Could I just pick up on what you were saying about why would we not tell the essential workers about these elevated conditions? Well, the cynic in me answers that question by saying, because we don't care about them, because we want them to, if we told them, that there are problems. They wouldn't go into people's houses and be the essential workers to help people. And these are just poor people and people of color and immigrants who are doing this work. And so why tell them? I think that has something to do with that decision.
Do you think that's the case, Bob? Is what you cover all the time, especially in New York.
Well, I think that one of the things is that I saw these men and women step up big time in March and April, where they were seeing what has really been underreported, which is the die-off in people's homes. Remember, the fixation of this country has been on managing the flattening the curve in terms of facilities and hospitals. What we still have not learned is what they learned in New Zealand and as diverse a places as Cuba, that the disease is in the community. Right. And so I believe that these detectives, because in New York City, the law is they have to go into every home where there's a dead body. Yeah. And six of them have already died as a consequence of it. So no, I think that their commitment to public service, we've already lost close to 300 civil servants in New York City alone.
I'm not talking about their lack of commitment to civil service. The opposite. I'm talking about society doesn't value them enough, and we write them off.
Well, and I think that what's happened is they're not even creating a list. One of the things that's very upsetting is that across the country, this is tearing through the essential workforce, leaving many people with long-term disability issues, and they're not even maintaining an effective list of who it's affecting.
Unbelievable. All right. Oh, this is so depressing. Let's go to the Democratic Convention again. Let's go to Democrats. So Dean Spiliotis, my presidential and civic scholar, I saw a piece at the Hill by Rahm Emanuel, my least favorite person. Anyway, Rahm Emanuel writes, Democratic Party needs to turn Biden Republicans into Democrats. And I read this article and I'm screaming and I'm going, no, that's not the answer. I mean, that's the problem, you know? I mean, we already were jealous of Republicans, which is why we became Republican light with Bill Clinton. Now what they want us to do is become the moderate Republican Party, and then there is no choice. You know, you got the lunatic Trumpets, if they hell know how long they're going to last, and then you're going to have, you know, moderate Republicans, which is maybe what Rahm Emanuel wants. But that's really not what I think the country needs, and frankly, where the base of the Democratic Party is going. So how do you respond to what should happen with the Biden Republicans? I mean, I don't know the answer, but becoming Democrats is not exactly, I think, the solution.
Yeah, and I don't know necessarily that will happen. You know, there's a whole conversation within the Republican Party and people who are former Republicans about, you know, focusing on getting Trump out of office now and then kind of figuring out how to rebuild a center-right party in the future. You know, it may take a while for the Republican Party to go through that change. If in fact it does, we don't know what's going to happen with Trump or who will follow up after him as leaders of the Republican Party. This could be a longer term enterprise. Arnie, we've had this discussion before. There's no doubt that the base of the Democratic Party has shifted to the left from where it was back in certainly where it was in the 90s with the Democratic Leadership Council and Rahm Emanuel and Bill Clinton and Joe Lieberman and Evan Bayh and that whole crowd. But there is a sense right now, I mean, Bernie Sanders was all over the airwaves over the weekend. And, you know, there is a sense right now that progressives are, for the most part, not, you know, some of them are not happy that John Kasich is speaking. But there's a sense that they're willing to kind of hold their fire for now in order to be part of potentially historic appointment of a woman of color as vice president, and that then they will begin the task of kind of figuring out how to move the Biden administration into more progressive terrain, you know, things like Medicare for all, et cetera. But this is going to be I think both parties are in the midst of ongoing debates and being reshaped. But the issue, I think right now, all that is being subsumed to, does Trump stay in or is Trump thrown out?
So, Stephen, the thing is, I'm going to disagree with Dean. Both parties aren't having this intramural fight. The problem is the Republican Party is not having this fight, Stephen. That's the problem. The problem is that there is an intramural fight within the Democratic Party. And that was before the Lincoln Project. And that was before, you know, John Kasich speaking at the Democratic Convention. And that was before, you know, you had Rahm Emanuel suggesting that those Biden Republicans should become Democrats. So there has already been an intramural fight. And I think that's really what we're seeing now. The question for, I think, the Lincoln Project is that there isn't a fight within the Republican Party. And isn't it isn't it their job is to take it back to the Republican Party, not to become Democrats?
That's what I'm talking about. I think I just maybe didn't characterize it appropriately. We're not in disagreement on that. You know, I understand that I should have been clearer. The Lincoln Project and all those folks, they're not in the Republican Party right now. But their interest is not in taking over the Democratic Party. It's rebuilding from the ashes of the current Republican Party, a new center-right party. So whether that's intramural on the outside looking in, it's a fair clarification.
Okay. And so, I mean, that was why I was concerned, Stephen, about Rahm's piece, because it sounded to me like he wanted to subsume them. And I was saying, no, create your party.
Well, I'm not sure there's great evidence that there are too terribly many people who listen to Rahm Emanuel in the first place. So I'm not sure how much that matters. You know, I will say that what we're seeing going on in the Republican Party right now, we've seen, people have been writing and talking about this literally for decades, right? Seeing the narrowing appeal of the Republican Party, shedding potential voters, right? We're to the point where, 90-something percent of Black Americans vote Democratic, almost 80% of Latinx populations vote Democratic, 75, 76, 77% of Asian Americans vote Democratic, pushing 60% of women vote Democratic, right? These are trends that have been amassing and are accelerating, right? And I think part of the logic, if you look at the Democratic convention, right, you've got John Kasich and Mike Bloomberg, and you've got Bernie Sanders and AOC, right? I think that part of what they are trying to do is saying, we are the big tent. Right. We are welcoming everyone right now. For the love of God, please vote Democrats. There's a space for you here. Right. And that's a credible claim right now. Right. And when you look at the core of the Republican Party, as Trump has accelerated the narrowness of their appeal. Right. If they do not figure out a way to legitimately bring in larger segments of the American population, the only alternative that they're going to have is stealing elections or seizing them by force, right? So they're going to have to come a point, if we're going to maintain a democratic society, that the Republican Party will either die or have to alter, literally, if it is going to occupy elected office.
So, Bob, as I'm thinking about the Republican Party, and it's not just Trump, it's also was a QAnon, and the fact that now I think three people have run for office on the Republican ticket and have won. A woman just won as a possible election to Congress, which is going to be so interesting. And that the pandemic has sort of given rise to their, I mean, they've always been there. But now they actually have a focus and they have a raison d'etre, and they're able to sort of bring together every conspiracy theory on the planet and Velcro them together. And then Donald Trump applauds them. So you've got this sort of echo chamber within the White House. And I think that's another reason why you would almost want these Biden Republicans to sort of storm back into the Republican Party, because it will die a horrific death. But the problem is that I keep saying that, is this election going to be an election that provides resolution, Bob, or revolution, Bob? And when I'm looking at these conspiracy theories winning their primaries, I really have to ask myself, what kind of message are we going to get out of this election when we finally sort of call the winners and the losers?
I think that, to go back to Stephen's analysis about the chaos being the point, that's this QAnon is what this achieves. I was disheartened to see the Democrats chose to put Kasich in the lineup and not Andrew Yang. I wonder if there's a case of somebody that created something authentic from the grassroots that was not alienated from capitalism and had come up with a series of solutions, which, as it turns out, are going to be required. And so I think that that's the kind of cultivation. You want to reward innovation and initiative. And I think the Democratic Party has to go some distance to explain that it's whatever it's doing in terms of reconsideration of the national promise and trying to meet some of our, you know, renewing the New Deal, if you will, that you need to have people like Yang and universal income at the heart of the national conversation.
Yeah. Well, you know, so Dean, you know why Kasich is there, because Biden still is in the time warp of being able to work bipartisanly. That's what this is all about. He wants to go back to the old days, and the party that he wants to go back to doesn't exist. It doesn't even like the Kasich that's going to be showing up on Monday night. They don't even acknowledge that he exists. But it's his attempt to talk about bipartisan. The bipartisan he needs is within his own party. I'm going back to you, Dean Spilios. That's the bipartisan he needs. He needs the yang. Like, Bob, that's a brilliant, write that salon piece. That's the bipartisan that Biden needs. It's not the Kasichs. It's not the Romneys. It's the Yangs. It's what's happening within his own sort of backyard, and he doesn't get it. You know, he's in that sort of time. The only advantage I think I have to some extent is that Kamala does get it. I think Kamala does sort of see what has happened because she's, again, like the immigrant experience that's so real for her, she has the McConnell experience that is so real for her. It's not that he hasn't experienced it with Barack Obama, but for her, it's been a little more front and center, and she doesn't have the luggage that Joe Biden has. She has the immediacy of the moment. But that is kind of the problem with the Kasichs, you know, being there on opening night.
Yeah, you know, I think Stephen's point is well taken that, you know, it's at some level, I think you're right, Arnie. Part of it is simply this kind of how Biden conceptualizes, you know, kind of old school notions of how you build a winning bipartisan coalition. I think for others, it's simply, you know, get as many people in under the tent temporarily as you can in order to assure that you have the appropriate margins of victory in order to overwhelm any Trump attempt at claiming that the election was rigged. Now, I don't know whether that'll happen or not, but I think people who are maybe not Kasich fans, but who are okay with it, I mean, that's kind of the short-term rationale that they're using. You know, Andrew Yang, you know, he was left off initially. I think they've added him, but only for a couple minutes. He will get to say something. Certainly that's a very different balance. That would be a very different balance in the party. I think the reality is whatever happens, if Joe Biden is elected, I think he will very quickly see, and I think this is what Bernie Sanders was hinting at over the weekend, that it's a different party now.
And I'm going to end with you, Stephen, because I do want to comment on the fact that AOC is given 60 seconds, and I think she speaks right before Bill Clinton, and I'm not sure how many minutes Bill Clinton is getting. You couldn't have a more yin and yang, pardon the expression, between her and him. And everyone was upset about the 60 seconds that AOC was given. In a lot of ways, the brevity of the time that they gave her almost enhanced everybody wanting to pay every second of attention to AOC. But what I said, Stephen, which is if you want to heal this party, what I think Bill Clinton should do, although he doesn't have the capacity to do it, is he should turn to AOC and say, don't go anywhere. Stay here. I want to share my time with you. I am the party of the past. You are the party of the future. Doesn't mean that I agree with you. But it does mean that, you know, I'm being given 10
Clinton?
Minutes.
Bill Clinton? Have you seen Bill Clinton? Yeah.
Leave me alone.
I want him to magically become an entirely different person and fundamentally alter his worldview for the purposes of this particular bit of theater?
Oh, okay. Okay. So I'm on a drug. All right. Anyway, on this drug, let me say goodbye to a phenomenal panel of guests for our Rethink the Week. Robert Hennelly, I adore you. Dean Spiliotis as well, and Stephen Pimpare. I can't imagine hanging out with a better set of gentlemen than the three of you, and Ken Barnes, my great producer. So everyone, we will see you on Tuesday, and Monday night's going to be interesting. I'll take copious notes, I promise. All right, ciao, bye-bye.
Get ready for me, love, cause I'm a comer. I simply gotta march, my heart's a drummer. Don't bring around a cloud of rain on my parade. I'm gonna live and live now. Get what I want, I know how. One roll for the whole shebang. One throw, that bell will go clang. Eye on the target and wham. One shot, one gunshot and bam! Hey, Mr. Armstead.